Appreciate it, man. I was talking to Ian this week, and I was thinking about it as I was prepping for today, but I think that middle ground of unanswered questions and suffering is the reason why we question our faith, but it's all the also the reason why we have faith in the first place. So when you come to a place where you want good to happen and you don't understand why bad happened, it causes us to question the things that we believe, like God is good, but at the same time, it absolutely causes us to have faith in the first place because we need something to lean on. And so we're in the Believe series, and this is week 3, and today is literally all about Jesus. And so let me tell you what I want to do today, because it's a little bit different. Instead of just kind of walking through the material that's online, you can go on our website under the teachings page. We wrote this one. It's not in the book, and you can read through it. Instead of doing that, what I want to do today is spend some time on the tensions of Jesus. Nobody changed history as much as Jesus. Whether you believe that he was God or not, nobody did. And at the heart of it is this belief that there's a God-man that came to earth, and that is something I can't fully explain. It is an absolute tension. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to spend some time asking questions that reflect the tensions that I don't have answers for. Some more nuanced questions that help us really dive into the character of Jesus, because here's why I think it's valuable. I think when confronted with tensions, we grow. I do. I think when we find those spaces that we don't have all the answers and we try and track them down anyway, we grow, because we will do anything to explain things in our culture, in every culture. We want answers. And at the bedrock of our faith is a God that we can't understand fully. And so what I want to do is spend some time and ask 3 questions that kind of build on each other, that bring up some tensions about the nature of Jesus being both God and both man. One thing that Ian and I like to do every year is we go on a ski trip. And I'm a snowboarder, so I'm better than most skiers just by nature, right? And Ian still yells at me for it, but I love it. I am mediocre at best, right? I go once a year, and I've probably gone about 7 times for 3 days. So you're not really going to build on getting really, really good. Ian is a good skier. Ian's kid, Christian, comes with us. He's a phenomenal skier. He's that skier that you see going down the chute that looks like it's almost inverted. It's so steep, full of moguls, and his legs look like they're about to bounce off his body, but his head and his upper body is just like stiff, you know? You scream at him when he's coming down the mountain, humans shouldn't bend that way. And then he gets down and he's like, that was fun, let's do it again. Christian's a great skier. Here's my problem. I'm a guy and I don't like to admit there's things I can't do, right? And so Christian looks at me, this has happened every year for the last 3, and he'll say, Charlie, let's go to the top of the mountain. The top of the mountain are where the good skiers go, right? And he says, Charlie, you can do it. And I think to myself, no, you can't. But I'm a guy, and I'm not going to say that out loud, right? Because I'm prideful. And so I say to him, okay, yeah, let's go to the top of the mountain. And right there, I know that I made a bad decision. That knot starts forming. And as you get higher and higher, it gets steeper and steeper. And you start thinking, what am I doing up here? I'm going to break something. And then when I get home, my wife's going to break the other thing because I broke something. And she told me not to hurt myself, right? Now here's the deal. One of my least favorite parts about going to the top of the mountain is fundamentally the list that you have to use to get to where you want to go change. So at the bottom of the mountain, the kid-friendly portion of the skiing zone, man, those lifts are great. And they come around the corner and they slow to almost a stop. You sit down on the little ski lift and they tuck you in, give you some hot cocoa, and they say, enjoy the mountain, you know? And as it gets up to the top, it slows down to almost a stop, and you gingerly get off the lift and go about your day. When you get higher and higher, where the better people are, the lifts are not as forgiving. When you get higher and higher, they don't slow down. They speed up when they pick you up, and they don't slow down when they drop you off. They, like, give you a boost out the front, right? And I'm terrified. At the very top of the mountain, to get some of the back bowls and ridge lines, there's something called a T-lift. I don't know if you guys know what a T-lift is. It's horrible is what it is. It is there for me to be made fun of, I'm convinced. A T-lift is not a chair at all. It is a bar. And when you get to the top, what happens is it doesn't pick you up at all. You keep your board on the mountain the entire time, and you got to kind of like balance and ski at the same time that it pulls you. And so it whips around this corner, and you got a line of people behind you that are really good because this is the top. And it whips around, and I'm sitting there the first time like, I got this. I'm not going to make an idiot of myself. and it whips around, and you throw this thing between your legs, and you're like trying to give it a go because it kind of slows a little bit. You're trying to give it a go, and then it picks you up and takes you and gives you some momentum. But here's the deal. If you don't do it right, you fall flat on your face. I mean, like flat on your face, and everybody knows it, and they look at you like, what are you doing here? The greens are down there, big man. You know what I'm talking about? The 7-year-old snowboarder behind me that's been doing this since he was 2 is trying to kick me out of the way, saying, old guy, move, and I'm rolling over the mountain, right? So I finally got it. And here's the crazy part about the T-lift. Is in order to, for this thing to catch you and for it to work, you have to sit there and wait, and then against all of the things, the fibers inside of you, you have to sit back and let the tension pull you forward. You have to sit back on this lift, and as the tension gets tighter and tighter, it catches you and drags you forward. Here's my point. I think as we ask questions that reveal tensions about God, about things we don't understand about Jesus, it will pull us forward. I think it helps us grow. And so today we have 3 questions. The first one's kind of dipping the toe in the water of tension, and the last 2 build off that, and they're filled with it. Some things I know the answers to, some things I don't. But my hope and my goal as we ask these questions is to do what Matthew says, which is love the Lord with our minds, 1. And then 2, my prayer is that the tensions help us start better conversations. Help us to ask good questions, and ultimately God will use that to help us grow. So let's dive in. This whole thing kind of started with the idea of let's explain Jesus as a God and a man at the same time. And there was a poll that came out a couple years ago, and it polled evangelicals. Not just the creasters, but like the people that were serious about the Lord. They came to church 2x a month, right? And they said, hey, let me ask you a bunch of questions about theology. And so one of the questions they asked was, hey, is Jesus like as much God as God the Father is God? And I was kind of surprised to learn that 31% of people that responded said Jesus isn't as God as God is God. 31% said they believe the Father is more divine than Jesus. So that's where we're going to start today as we build. So our first question is this. It's what percentage of Jesus is God? What percentage of Jesus is God? I know you all know the answer, but we're really going to walk this through, okay? So if you got a Bible, let's go to Colossians 1, everybody. Colossians 1, written by Paul to a church at Colossae, and the church had some problems. Not like this one, it had real problems. It literally had a bunch of guys walking around telling everybody that they didn't know everything there was to know about God. And they couldn't, because God only told them a special revelation. These people would walk around, and we have it today, and they say, God told me a word that you don't know. And in order to get the fullness of who God is, you have to follow me and listen to what I say. It's a heresy. And so what Paul does when he writes this letter at the very beginning is say, look, there's not a special revelation about Jesus that you don't have. I'm going to lay it all out for you right here, right now. And we find ourselves in chapter 1. Look at verse 15 with me. It says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He's before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the head of the body and of the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him. This is the richest section of Christology, the theology of Christ, that we have in the entire scriptures. And what he does is he lays out multiple ways why Jesus is God. Look at verse 15. It starts right there. It says that he is the image of the invisible God. He's the firstborn of all creation. So what that means is not literally that he was born first. So like Mormons would read that and say, hey, look, he was a created being. That's not what the word means in the Greek. The firstborn word has a couple different meanings. And we see them actually both in this text. But one of the things that it meant often in the scriptures is an order of birth, but supremacy. So what he's saying is that Jesus is the image of God, and he's better than everything else that's ever been created. Don't even try to ask. He's not saying that he was created first, but that he's better than everything. Because here's the clue, God is better than his creation. And so he's saying, hey, he is better than all of it. And then he goes on and says he's also God because he created. Verse 16. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible. So what he's doing is he's building a case for the deity of Christ. And he's doing it the same way we built the case for the deity of God a few weeks ago. He's saying not only does he reflect God, but he also, in a very real way, created. And we said, hey, God is God because he created. And so that ascribes godness to him. Nobody created that we don't call God. It's a proof for the existence of God. So he's saying Jesus is God in likeness, he's God in resemblance, and he's God in action and in function. And then he's going to say that, hey, not only is he that, if you look down and read verse 17, 16 and 17, he says he has dominion over everything. So he reflects God, he's the image of God, he created just like God, and he has the power over everything just like God, right? Because we're going to say that only one being, one entity can create and have power over their creation, and that's God. And he's saying this is what Jesus is. The same things you thought of God the Father, think of Jesus. I think one of my favorite phrases in this whole thing says that he holds all things together. That's crazy to me. So when you think about our world, it's pretty fragile. There's a physicist who I'm going to blank on his name, but I like the guy. And he's not a believer. And he talks about the fragility of our world. And so, you know, this world is at like a certain tilt. I want to say like 20-ish, 22 degrees. I don't know. I went to Bible college, people. They don't teach that stuff. So it's tilted and then it's like catapulting forward into the universe. We're going at something like 16,000 miles an hour. Again, I'm not lying. I'm kind of ballparking it because we didn't have science 101 at Moody. We had hermeneutics 101, okay? And so it's catapulting through the world. And they asked this physicist, the leading physicist in the world, actually, hey, what would happen if the Earth's tilt changed by a degree or if it just stopped moving for a little bit? And he said, utter chaos. Utter chaos. He's saying, Jesus, the text tells us, not only has authority over the world, but he holds it together so it doesn't fly off into utter chaos. That's the majesty of this guy that you think is just a man. He's saying he's way more than that. Because the ability to do that reflects only one thing, and that's God. Deity. In function, in form, in action, and in authority, he is God in every single way. And then it goes on to say, at the end of that, that he will reconcile all things in verse 19, for it was the Father's good pleasure to have all the fullness dwell in him. He rounds out his case again, a little inclusio there. Starts it in 15 with that, and then ends it in 19 with that, just in case you didn't know where he was going. It's beautiful. So you're saying Jesus is God because he created and because he has authority over it? And that gives him authority because he created, right? It's like you have a kid, and you can tell your kid what time to go to bed because you made the kid, and you sustain life for the kid, right? It's why I don't in any way like cats. If you do, that's great. Work through that tension in your life. Hope you come out the other side. I don't like cats because, quite simply, if I'm going to pay for you to exist and be the reason why you're not dead, don't make me earn your affection every day, you know? Ian Cook has a great joke. I've said it before, but he says, he said, put your dog and your wife in the trunk of your car, come back an hour later and see who's happy to see you, right? I love dogs. They're happy to see you all the time. You miss a meal, they're just excited, you know? I love dogs. So he's saying that Jesus is God in every single way. God is God. Not just image, but in authority. Not just authority, but in creative design. Not just creative design, but in reconciling. He is God. And then on the flip side of that, we get a beautiful picture in the scriptures about the absolute humanity of Jesus. Turn, my Bible is like one page over, but Philippians chapter 2. Philippians 2, you have a beautiful passage on the humanity of Christ. The fact that he is not just fully God, which was proven, but that he's also fully man. It starts in verse 5. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. Although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. We're going to come back to these two passages a couple times, but really what we come down to is this idea that he was God fully, and then he became fully man. So he took on the appearance and the likeness of men, not kind of halfway, but all the way. He looked like one of us. In John 1:14, we talk about it all the time. It says the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. Word being Jesus literally took on not just skin, but humanity in totality. And right there is really, when you think about it, our first tension. Because if you sit down, and I've studied this for a while and paid money to study it, if you sit down and say, Charlie, explain to me the intricacies of the God-man, how it could be fully both of those, I'm going to say I can't. I can try. But I will never be able to give you a full answer on that. Ever. And I don't know if you guys like church history. I do a lot. And it's a question they stumbled through over the years as well. Started in about 325. If I could have been alive for any part of church history, it probably would have been the Council of Nicaea. So you got to understand, to give a little backstory, Christianity was opposed heavily in Rome. And it went through different periods of hate, essentially. Biggest times being about 70 AD and 250-ish AD. When I say opposed, I mean they were sought out and killed. Nero used Christians as torches in his gardens, dipped them in tar, lit them on fire so he could see as he walked around. They would make sport of in the Colosseum, bears and tigers and lions. They would rip them apart and people watched and cheered. In 313, that all changed. Constantine rose up, conquered under the name of Jesus, and said, from now on, we're going to worship God. We're going to worship, you know, the God of the Jesus God, that idea of God. And so overnight, literally, it became something that you died for to something that was expected of you. Radical shift. And so what happened when you allow Christ or any kind of theology or any kind of anything to be talked about in the public space is you have deeper conversations about it because you have more time to talk about it. And so what started happening was as it became legal, people talked more about it and they realized we think different things about the nature of Jesus. You have some people saying Jesus is fully God all the way. And there was a faction of other people called Arians who thought literally that he wasn't all the way God, but he was mostly God, but he was still really great. And so in 325, Constantine said, we're all going to get together. We're going to hash it out under the same roof. And we're going to come up with what we believe about this prayerfully and as we seek through the scriptures. And so they did. In 325, you had all these people, like some commentators talk about the fact that they were probably limping in. And why I'd want to be here is because these guys that showed up to talk about Jesus, it was still real. They probably were missing limbs from bears, and they probably lost husbands and wives and kids and parents that died because they believed in Jesus. They all come together and they say, let's talk about God. More specifically, the nature of Jesus. And they came up with this term that's found in Hebrews chapter 1, and essentially it means that Jesus is the same stuff, little substance, homoousios, as God. There's no differentiation. But our desire to explain things, because that still leaves it way out there in the tension, took over again about 50, 60 years later. Other heresies started to pop up. There was one that said that, yep, Jesus in his flesh was fully man, but in his spirit and in his mind and in his will, he was all the way God and not man at all. It's like the Freaky Friday Jesus. You know that movie where Jamie Lee Curtis is an adult and some other person is a kid? I don't remember her name, but she's a ginger. She's a kid, and they say like the phrase at the same time, and they swap, and now all of a sudden you got the mother's head, like mind, will, and emotions inside of the kiddo's body. That's what they're saying happened, that Jesus took on a body, but he still remained only deity in his mind, will, and emotion. But when you search the scriptures, that doesn't hold up. Because at one point in the garden, Jesus is praying and he says, hey, not my will, but yours be done. So you seem to have two natures in the same spot. Go a little bit farther at about 400 AD and you find like this other kind of heresy that said, wait a second, it was actually two completely different people, like two completely different beings inside of one. But that doesn't really vibe either with the scriptures because over and over again, Jesus refers to himself as I and not we, as he and not they. You never, in any part of the scriptures, never once, you never see somebody refer to the humanity of Jesus without the deity of Jesus. You never see his two natures fight each other in some sense, like the two beings that they thought that he lived in fight each other. And you never, not once in any of this, see any kind of action that he had ascribed to a certain part of his being. So what we don't say is, man, the humanity of Jesus really rocked that Beatitude sermon, right? And the deity of Jesus really crushed lunch today as he fed 5,000. We just say, Jesus did that. The Bible does, and all church leaders throughout history has said that. And so we get this idea that we're wrestling with the tension of that which we can't explain. He has completely two fully developed natures in one being. And that leads us to about 450 in the Council of Chalcedon. What happened was they finally got together and they put words to our idea, even Orthodox's theology of Jesus. And they had some phrasing I want to read to you guys. They said it like this. Part of it was, teach men to confess one and the same Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. The same perfect in Godhead and also perfect in manhood. Truly God and truly man. And that phrase changed. It put language to our theology of the God-man. Something called the hypostatic union. Impress your friends later on or just think I'm smart. Either one is fine. The hypostatic union is literally the two natures inside of the one person of Jesus. One theologian said, because of this hypostatic one-person union, Jesus Christ exhibits an unparalleled magnificence. No one person satisfies the complex longings of the human heart like the God-man. But we are human beings, and the unincarnate deity doesn't connect with us the same way as the God who became human. The conception of a God who never became fully man like Allah will not satisfy the human soul like the God who did. It's this idea built in to the theology of Christ that we need both. I might not be able to explain it, but we absolutely need both in full. And the tension is because Jesus is God and how he saves and he's human and the fact that he was without sin. And you see these two things together but never conflict, together but never fully separated. They are one and the same person. And in that, we have some really great questions to ask. That's the first tension that we have to explain. It's the fact that he's fully both. I can't get you all the way there, but I know it to be true based on scriptures and church history. Our next question that builds off of that question, if he's fully God and fully man, did Jesus give up, I love this question, did Jesus give up some of his godness when he became human? All right, so let me dive into the tension of this question real quick. The tension is pretty simply this. If you believe that God is God, you believe what we believe about God's characteristics, the omnis, right? Omnipresent, omniscience, omnipotent. God knows all, is everywhere, and is stronger than you and anything else you could think of, right? That's kind of the basic idea of the characteristics of God. So that if Jesus is God, which the scriptures seem to indicate fully, then he has to share the omnis with God because he is God fully. Here's the point, is that throughout the scriptures, we seem to have examples of Christ not being the omnis. In Luke 2:52, Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and favor with God and men. In Matthew 13, his disciples say, hey, Jesus, when's this thing going to come to an end? And he says, man, I don't know. We're going to have to ask God. He's the only one that knows. God the Father. And in Matthew 4, we see examples, and in Matthew 8, of him getting tired and him getting weary. And so my question, and here's the tension, is if God knows all, how can Jesus still be learning if he is God? If Jesus is fully powerful, how can he be tired? If Jesus really is God in every single sense of the word, how can he not know when he's coming back? I thought God was omniscient. We seem to have a conflict here between some of the characteristics. Because how can he be fully God and grow and get tired and not know? How can that exist in the same space? Because we know this is true of God. So go to Philippians 2 again. Let's walk through some text. In Philippians 2, again, he's talking about the idea of Jesus taking on flesh. And so in trying to explain this question, which is a really good one, there are some different ideas as to what happened, right? And so if you look at verse 6 with me, it says, and we just read it, but who although he existed in the form of God, he didn't regard equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of man. So that word emptied himself is really, really key to our conversation. It's kenoo in the Greek, and literally there's a whole theology called the kenosis theology that would say that Jesus let go of his deity for a little while when he came to earth to accomplish the mission that he came to accomplish, because he had to be fully man. And so there's a theology out there that's going to say, you know what? He set his godness aside just for a time, picked it back up after the resurrection so that he could accomplish what he had to. So when it says that Jesus grew, it means he literally grew because he was fully human. And this is how we can say he didn't know, because how could he have known? He was fully human and he set his omniscience aside for a little while. And when he did miracles, it was God working through him. I don't really fall under that theology a little bit for two reasons. One is, think of it like this. If you're a student and you're going to college and you're paying for it all on your own because your parents want you to grow up to be a responsible adult. You're paying for it all on your own, and man, you need to take a semester off and get a job so you can pay for the next semester, which, you know, happens all the time. And so you take a semester off and work full time so that you can pay. Here's the deal, is even though you were a student, in that semester you're not a student anymore if you're not taking any classes. So my point is, if Jesus set aside his deity, then he's no longer fully God. And we run into some problems there. So we're asking the question, did he literally empty himself of deity? I have to say no, because if there was any time in any space that Jesus set aside his deity at all, he's no longer fully God and fully man. And that's the bedrock we come back to, is that he's fully God and fully man. So when we look at Philippians 2, if you look at the context of the whole thing, essentially what Paul is saying is be unified. Be unified because the gospel's worth it. Be unified because that's what it does. Be unified because the gospel's bigger than you. And by the time we get to verse 5, 6, and 7, what he's saying as an example is Jesus. He's saying, look at Jesus. He was not in any way, shape, or form wanting to grasp more godness because he was already God, but he set aside the glory of his deity so that he could accomplish a bigger picture. And what he's arguing for the church there is for the people there to set aside their glory a little bit and act within the body as humble individuals that make this whole thing work. So I think that it's a better way to say it. He didn't give up his deity. What he did was he veiled it and didn't abandon the divine attributes. So it looks something like this. I don't know if you guys grew up in a household where your parents at an early age decided it was a good idea to let you beat them in things, right? Mine did not. And there's two different philosophies here. One is my kid needs to be coddled, so let them beat me at basketball. And two is my kid needs to learn that I'm better than him, and I will beat him at basketball, right? And that was my parents. My dad was a good basketball player. I loved basketball. My dad played in college a little bit, and I am the runt of my family's litter, right? My brothers and my father are like 6'13 and a half, and on a good day, I'm 5'9 with big heels on, you know? And so, you know, you don't have to laugh at me, with me, people. And so when we played growing up in the back, my dad could always beat me. Always. He could block every shot I took from when I was 9 to when I was about 15. He could dribble around me. He could stop me when I was trying to dribble around him. It just wasn't even close. And my dad did not let me win, by the way. I was not a coddled child. But at the same time, he let me score sometimes. He'd let me drive around him. He'd let me make a layup. He'd do the whole like feign, like, oh, I can't get there thing, you know, and oh, good shot. And then he'd beat me down when I got cocky, like every good parent should do to their kids. But here's the point is that even in those moments where my dad let me drive around him and get a layup, it's not that he didn't have the ability to stop me and said he chose not to use it then and there. It's not that he didn't have the ability to beat me. He just said, hey, right now, I'm not going to go there. So when we say, did Jesus give up some of his godness? Did he abandon it? Did he give it away? I think the answer is no, but he chose not to use it for a time. He still had access to it, still could have. Just said, yeah, I'm not going to use it right now when I'm here. So how could he be tired? Because he said, hey, I am omnipotent if I want to be, and right now I'm human. And the hard part is we want to say right now he was one and not the other, and that's not necessarily true either because he's both at the exact same time. A great example of this is Matthew chapter 8, right? And for time's sake, I will absolutely fly over this quickly, but essentially what happens is Jesus is in a boat with his disciples, and at least four of them are fishermen. They do this for a living. It starts raining. It gets really bad. Jesus is tired, right? So he starts sleeping, and the experienced fishermen say, hey, we're going to die. We need to wake Jesus up, and they did. And they said, why don't you care that we're going to die? And Jesus says, come on, guys, seriously? And so he was tired, and he slept through it, because he's a heavy sleeper. He does everything well. He's God. He's a heavy sleeper. And then he wakes up, and he goes to the edge of the boat, and he looks out at the water. That was the most feared substance they knew, because it was uncontrollable. And he looks at the water, and he says, stop it. And the water just stopped. And we have a beautiful picture of his humanness and his divineness interplaying with one another in the same space. How can he be human and divine at the same time? He chose to veil it and not act on it all the time, but it was still always accessible to him. So how can God learn? Because he's 100% man. How can God grow? He's 100% man. How can he not know? Because he's saying, hey, I don't know in my humanity. Because I'm fully that. It's why Jesus came out of the womb not walking and talking, because that's scary and we would have heard about it by now, right? But he learned and grew like everybody else. He just set those aside for a little bit, but still had access to them, right? Didn't abandon, veiled them. Which then gets to my next question, question three, which again, I really like. It's, could Jesus have sinned? So fully God, fully man at all time. Fully God, fully man, but sometimes he chose to act in his divinity or not, right? His omnis or not. And so my next question, and the last one we're going to really deal with today, is could Jesus have sinned? Hard question. Hard question, because we're not saying, did he? The answer is no. We're saying, could he have sinned? Here's the tension in this question. If you go to James chapter 1, for God cannot be tempted by evil. So I love this, because you got to understand there's things that God cannot do. And that's hard sometimes, because we think God can do whatever he wants. That's not true. The way it looks in theological circles is somebody will sit down and ask you, can God make a rock so big even God couldn't pick it up, right? And usually the freshman in Sys 301 smiles like he just cracked the Da Vinci Code. Anyway, it's a great question, and it's one that should incur a lot of thought. But here's the truth of it, is that God literally can't act outside of his very nature. So can God make a rock so big God can pick it up? No. He can't act outside of his nature. So it says God cannot be tempted by evil. God cannot sin. It's not that he chooses not to. It's that he cannot sin. Keep the basketball analogy going. Look, let's compare me to LeBron James, because that's pretty similar, right? If I'm on a fast break and LeBron's on a fast break and LeBron goes up and lays the basketball up and in and doesn't dunk, he chose not to dunk, but he could have. If I go up and lay the basketball in, I did not choose not to dunk. I will tell my friends I chose not to dunk, but there was no way, shape, or form a choice about it, right? On a good day, I can touch the net when I jump, and I feel like I'm flying. There's a difference between choice and possible, and what we're saying is that it is impossible, not just by choice, but by its very nature, not possible for God to sin or God to be tempted. So here's the tension. Look at Hebrews 4. We'll have it up on the screen. It says, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. God cannot be tempted. Jesus is God. Therefore, Jesus cannot be tempted. Wait a second, Hebrews said that he was tempted in every way. And then I take it a step farther and say, if we believe that Jesus wasn't ever tempted, does that mean that, can you never be tempted and be truly human? So we have these tensions, man, that pull on us a little bit. And I think for this one, where I would go to talk about is probably James 1 again. If you want to go there, you can flip there with me. But we need to talk about the difference between the kinds of temptations there are. So I think tempted exists on a couple levels, and it does in the words in the Greek too. But I think there's tempted and then there's tempted. One is like I could and one is desire. And there's a big difference there. So for example, I think that the worst food is broccoli, right? It's disgusting. It's little mini oak trees that you're trying to eat, people. Nobody drives through Double Oak and says, that looks good, I'm hungry now. Like, that is gross to me. And you can do whatever you want. You can put ranch dressing on it if you want to, but all you're doing there is making it taste like ranch, because that's all ranch does, right? And so I hate broccoli. If you sit there and wave a plate of broccoli in front of my face, even if I'm famished, I am not tempted to eat the broccoli. No part of me is like, that would be good. I can't help myself. Now, if I smell or look at or see a basket of fries within a 5-block radius, I will step over small children to get it in my mouth, right? I love French fries. Desire is there. So if you wave fries in front of me and I'm hungry, oh my goodness, yes. Everything inside of me, and I've tried to do some diets with my wife, and French fries are my downfall, and I'm sitting there conflicted because my desire is nothing more than to eat them all and then lie about it. So there's two separate things there. So there's a difference between, hey, I can maybe, and I have a desire to. Look at James 1. It's the passage we read from that said God can't be tempted. It's going to define what tempting is. It says, let no one say that he is tempted. Let no one say I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. It says in verse 14, but each one is tempted. It's about to define what tempted is. Each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. So what he's saying is that God is not tempted ever in desire, ever in desire. So how does this relate to the idea of Jesus and being tempted? I would say that Jesus could be tempted in his natural capacity, but never, ever, ever in his moral capacity. So Christ, could he have literally sinned, done the physical act of it? Yeah, but would he have? Never. So could Jesus have sinned? No. Because he could be tempted in the natural, but never in the moral. Never, it never rose to the level of desire. So when it says that God isn't tempted, Jesus wasn't. And it goes back to the idea that he's fully God, which means that he has no sin nature, which we adopted from Adam. Another sermon, and I'm already running behind. But what he's saying is that because we are slaves to sin, because Adam sinned, we can't help but be drawn towards that. Jesus doesn't have that draw. And so literally, he is never tempted because he never has the desire to go against God's ways. So no, he can't. It just doesn't exist in him. And it's really kind of beautiful because what we do is we say, well, then if he wasn't tempted like that, does he understand me? Like Hebrews said, he understands me. And I think absolutely yes. And this is the beauty of the tension of Jesus. It is that at the end of the whole thing, he's the only God that I've read about and studied and know of that decided to enter into our sin, to enter into the world and suffer with us for a while so that one day he can say there's a hope for something better. And so can we say that Jesus, if he wasn't fully tempted as we are in that way, can we say that he didn't know what we go through? I think absolutely not, because I've never been divorced, but I know what loss feels like. And there's a difference between understanding and experiencing. And so when it says in Hebrews that we have a high priest that knows what we go through, it's the only God that stepped into our world and said, I will suffer with you to show you what it looks like to be compassionate, to show you what it looks like to love, and to show you what it looks like to provide hope through all of it. And as we talk about these tensions, really the last question that we have as we wrap it up is, why does any of this matter? You know, these are nuanced questions. In every single way, they're nuanced questions. And if we just talk about the nuance and not relate it back to how this changes how we think about Jesus, then we're not doing our jobs. But fundamentally, I think that when we ask deeper questions, we know God more intimately. I think it's true about any facet of our life. It's the difference between first dates and fourth dates. I can ask where you want to travel to and what's your favorite food and do you like dogs and cats, but there's a difference between that and what your hopes and what your fears and what your desires and how's life going and what's it look like for you to suffer, to have joy or hope. When we ask deeper questions, at the very end of it, hopefully we get to know God more. I think it's why we do it. That's why Paul says, hey, don't stop with the easy stuff, but press through. So today, hopefully, we have a space for that. It opens our eyes up to the tension that is the God-man that I can't explain and neither can you. I think also we ask these kind of questions and we have spaces to talk about them because the way we think about God in every single way changes the way we interact with God. And again, that's true about everything and everybody. The way that we think about our parents changes the way we interact with them. Look at a kid when he's 4 or a kid when he's 40. He treats his parents differently because he knows them better and has probably, hopefully, more respect for them than the simple 4-year-old can probably fathom about his parents. So my point about Jesus being both God and man at the same time, I think the more that we grasp it, the more we see the character and nature of God. So for example, John chapter 11, it's a moving story about Jesus. And he walks up to his best friends and one of them died in Lazarus. And they run up to him and said, if you got here earlier, you could have stopped this. Shortest verse in the Bible, we probably all know it, but Jesus just weeps. He just weeps. And I've taught it like this before, and it's true. We teach and say, look at the humanity of Jesus shining through in that moment that he feels our pain and that he weeps with us. And that is absolutely true. But at the same time, if I understand more clearly the union of the two natures of Jesus, N.T. Wright says that verse, and he says, when I read that verse, I just don't see Jesus crying as a human. I read that verse, and I think to myself, look, God weeps. And it reminds me of his compassion and his goodness and his love and his sympathy for his people. I think as we talk about these things, hopefully we get a better picture of the character and the nature of God. Because ultimately, tension pulls us forward, you know? And I think the fear sometimes when we talk about tension or not talk about tension is it challenges the very confidence we have in God. But if you really think about it, it doesn't challenge my confidence in God at all. It challenges my confidence in me, right? Go back to the ski slopes, right? So if I'm on this T-lift and this T-lift makes me fall flat on my face, I'm not getting up and saying, man, that lift is broken. I'm getting up and saying, man, I'm not very good at this yet, you know? And if I get up and say the lift is broken, I'm just cocky. So when I ride through tensions in the scripture about the nature of Jesus, which I can't nor will ever be able to explain fully, what it doesn't do for me is challenge the confidence I have in the goodness of God and the character of God. It challenges my ability to understand. And then I always wrestle with the idea that God is bigger than my comprehension. And hopefully that's a joyous thing. Because if I could comprehend the fullness of a God who's bigger than me, he's not a great God. And where it leads me, and where we're going to end today, is it just leads me to a place of worship. I love the tensions because they pull us forward. My prayer is they give us confidence in God. My prayer is they start better discussions. My prayer and my hope is that through that, we know God better and that we grow. Let me pray for us before we worship again. God, I'm thankful for who you are. I'm thankful that you're bigger than us. I'm thankful for Jesus. Fully God, fully man, I will not all the way be able to understand the whole thing, but I pray that as we ask some challenging questions that you give us confidence. I pray that as we ask challenging questions, you remind us of your goodness and of your glory that's bigger than our comprehension. And as we worship, let us dwell in the fact that you are good and you are great and that you are not understandable all the way, and that leaves me with awe. It's in the name of Jesus that I pray these things. Amen.